Some killers attack complete strangers. Some target the vulnerable, the young, or the elderly. And some prey on people that they know. There are killers who are inspired by money or by revenge, by sexual deviancy, by hatred. There are opportunists and there are meticulous planners. But what unites these men and women is one simple trait, and it's the most terrifying thing of all. They live amongst us. In our towns, on our streets, in our houses. They're just like the rest of us, but capable of evil. And they could be anywhere. Welcome to Murder Town.
Do you feel it in the air?
Every town in the UK has an underbelly of violence. But occasionally the crimes are so bad that they shock even the most hardy of communities. Tonight we're in Barnsley in South Yorkshire. Now, that's my hometown. So for me, it evokes memories of the football club and also my nan's homemade Yorkshire puddings. But like anywhere, the streets of Barnsley also conjure up more sinister memories. And this is a town that will never forget one of its darkest chapters.
This was a horrifying, vicious attack.
He had suffered horrendous injuries, including fractured cheekbones and eye sockets.
Some of the blows were so hard, they broke the bone in his ribs.
Nobody knew who, why or how. The public of Barnsley were absolutely terrified of what might happen.
I was dropped off by my work colleague on Wombwell High Street. A woman came running towards me and said, John has been found dead down at his house. I was absolutely shocked.
The dead man was John Gogarty, a 69-year-old Irishman who lived in the town. His best friend was Joe.
I immediately made a beeline for the property. There was a police cordon in place. I got past the police cordon and got to talk to his son. I asked him what had happened. He said, "There's a lot of blood, Joe."
The killer had used extreme violence. Gogarty had been stabbed 69 times in an attack that would have taken several minutes.
It was a very brutal murder. That it started at the front door very viciously. It continued in its brutality to the point that I believe almost 70 stab wounds to the man and some of his ribs broken. So it sounds like it was a pretty brutal attack.
This incident happened in a part of the Barnsley district called Wombwell. very close-knit community, a former mining community. Around 15,000 people or so live there. And it's one of those places where almost everyone knows everyone.
It's got issues like all small communities. It's got drug issues, it's got unemployment issues, but it's not a wealthy area. There is some wealth around it, but they're good, honest, working-class people.
But now, this close-knit community was hearing the news that one of its own had been found murdered.
Anybody, no matter where they lived, would be shocked by what happened. If there's a murderer next door, you're going to be shocked. A murder of this ferocity, you know, that is going to have huge shock waves.
John, as an individual, was a quiet, reserved man. He was choosy about the company he kept. He wasn't loud or brash or anything like that. I think John found it pretty tough to trust people. He was very guarded. I believe it stemmed from an incident that he had where he was robbed in his own house, where jewellery was taken from him.
He'd been attacked a few years before this happened in a completely unrelated incident, but it had put him basically in a position where he was concerned about his security.
In fact, John was so concerned that he never opened his front door.
When I would be going to meet him at his house, he would always ask me to ring and hang up when I was about a minute away from the house so he could move towards the front door. But even when I got to the front door and knocked, he would first ask me to identify myself. I think it stayed in his mind a long time that he'd been robbed on his own property.
But now it seemed that John had been attacked again in his house, and this time he hadn't survived. The community was struggling to cope with the news.
People were worried. You know, a brutal murder has happened and the murderer is out there somewhere, and so it leaves the community, I guess, feeling vulnerable, including myself.
A killer was on the loose, and Barnsley was in fear. But no one quite expected what was about to come.
I collapsed on the settee, and I cried like a baby.
Every town in the UK has its secrets, but there are some places that deserve the status of murder town. And Barnsley's no exception.
Well, Barnsley is a very working class town, situated in the centre of industrial South Yorkshire. Its main industries were coal, glass, and linen.
It has its own football club, of course, as do all the towns in South Yorkshire. A magnificent town hall as well. And it's a very proud place.
Murder is quite unusual in Barnsley. It's certainly true to say that Barnsley kind of cheated the hangman for many, many years.
But in 2015, Barnsley was at the centre of a murder investigation. A man called John Gogarty had been found dead in his home in the area of Wombwell, an ex-mining community to the southeast of Barnsley.
It was a very brutal murder, almost 70 stab wounds to the man and some of his ribs broken. Most people were very, very shocked and annoyed that this had happened in their little community. Tears were shed that night.
Now the police were desperately trying to find out who killed him.
The
This is the street where John Gogarty lived and where he was killed. John was a property developer originally from Ireland. He was a granddad, he was a dad, and he was known locally as Irish Paddy because of his Irish connections. He was a popular figure in the local community, and plenty of people knew him and liked him.
I got to know John. We sort of got a bit of banter going because two Irish men in a small South Yorkshire town, it was nice. John as a person was a really good businessman, but he didn't seem to be socially comfortable at times, and sometimes the company he kept just wasn't the sort of company I'd keep. When he was drinking, he sometimes would flash the cash, and it could be quite a wad of money. He always said he liked to have a certain amount of money on him. I tried to often tell him, please, don't pull out wads of cash in front of people. It's only laying temptation where it shouldn't be laid. He was surrounding himself with wrong ones who were just parasites who just wanted of him and had nothing to give in return. And they were socialising with other wrong ones who I knew could be maybe even worse than that. That was the sort of lowlifes that were hanging in the shadows.
So one of the initial lines of inquiry was that John had been targeted for his money.
It was quickly established by the police that Mr. Gogarty had left his local pub, walked home, settled in for the evening, had his slippers on, had the television on, when he'd answered the door, at which stage he'd been attacked. Some of the blows were so hard, they broke the bone in his ribs. It was an absolutely horrendous, horrifying attack.
But John Gogarty was known to be security conscious after being attacked several years earlier and would never open his door to strangers.
He was very guarded in that sense and very security conscious, even having the windows replaced so that they couldn't be put in. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, it's somebody he knows, or he wouldn't have opened the door. I was lying in bed at 5:30 in the morning. There was a knock on the front door. I looked out the window. There was two gentlemen in suits. They said, police, come down, please. They asked me to identify myself. I told them my name, and all hell broke loose. Uniformed officers came from everywhere. I was grabbed and told I was being arrested on the suspicion of the murder of John Gogarty. That night was probably the loneliest night of my life, thinking that there was a family who had been ripped to bits, and now they're wondering, has their father's best friend been actually the man who took his life?
Police had learned that in the days before John's death, he and Joe had had an argument.
John and I had fallen out over triviality. I'd come down to ask him for a favour. He started giving me a lecture on my relationship. So I says, if you're going to be like that, I don't want any favours off you. You can stick it up your ass. And unfortunately, they were the last words that I would say to him face to face. The police kept coming back to it, but what they don't realise is that Irish lads, we talk to each other like that. If you hear two Irish men in a bar insulting each other, it's probably because they are best friends.
Joe was innocent of John's murder. Police were able to establish their relationship and rule him out of their list of prime suspects.
They released me on bail of zero. They brought me back to my house. I collapsed on the settee and I cried like a baby.
But while police had been questioning Joe, detectives had also been looking at other leads. John Gogarty had been found on a Friday, but pathologists thought he may have been dead for several days. So detectives worked backwards to determine when he was last seen. One clue they had was a piece of paper lying close to his body.
One of the things found at the murder scene was a receipt from a nearby cash machine a few hundred yards from Mr. Gogarty's house.
Police hoped it would narrow down the time of the murder. The receipt was from the Monday, 4 days before John's body was found. But when they went to look at CCTV at the cash point, police were in for a shock.
Police worked out which the cash point was, looked at the CCTV. They identified a woman who was withdrawing money at the exact same time that was shown on the receipt.
But who was this woman? Why was she withdrawing cash from Mr. Gogarty's account? And was she anything to do with his murder? A manhunt was now underway, with police trawling their database of known offenders and hunting for more images. But it wasn't the first time in Barnes's history that a murderer had struck. In 2001, jealous lover Daniel Thompson stabbed a man to death with a kitchen knife before dismembering his body and scattering it in woodland. And in 2011, Martin Fieldhouse shot a father dead in a case of mistaken identity. He was jailed for 30 years for the cold-blooded execution. But one manhunt that would leave a lasting impact on Barnsley began back in 1995 in the Oakwell part of the town.
I was the head of CID in South Yorkshire Police. Well, it was a normal day, and the operations room called me and gave me the information that a man had been found murdered in his house. I then travelled to Barnsley to make the arrangements to investigate the crime. We are standing at the moment on Belgrave Road, the place where a man was murdered.
Maurice, it was a quiet, well-spoken, well-dressed. He'd been a hard-working man, employed by the local brewery for most of his life. He was quiet, but he did enjoy a drink. Just a social drink out with friends. He was certainly not the person you would expect to meet the death that he did.
Morris's body had been found in his home, just a stone's throw from the city centre.
But it's part of a normal residential area, just a short while away from the Barnsley Football Club. Maurice Hoyle was a fanatical Barnsley football supporter.
Police officers at the scene could immediately tell that whoever had killed Maurice had used extreme violence in what appeared to be a sustained attack.
We soon learned that he'd been hit with a whiskey bottle and then that he'd been subjected to kicks and stamping to his head and face. He had suffered horrendous injuries, including fractured cheekbones and eye sockets. Maurice Hoyle actually died as a result of his dentures being broken and lodging in his throat and restricting the airway. Nobody knew who, why or how.
This type of crime always causes concern in the community. People are shocked at the fact that somebody has been murdered within close range to where they live, and it makes them afraid for their own safety.
Now the town of Barnsley was about to realise that there was a killer in its midst. Cops feared that if he wasn't caught soon, he could kill again. In 1995, police in Barnsley were investigating the unusual murder of 69-year-old Morris Hoyle. He'd been found dead in his own home, having been savagely beaten. But Morris didn't have any enemies, and there was no sign of forced entry. So whoever the killer was, it seemed he'd been invited in, and word of the crime was starting to spread.
The public of Barnsley were shocked and indeed probably outraged at what happened to Morris Hoyle, an elderly man who was subjected to a really nasty, savage beating in his own home. I think anybody with any old person in the family was absolutely terrified of what might happen.
Murder is a very rare event. Makes the local community quite afraid for their own safety and for the safety of the families. So it's important that we make sure that not only is our investigation at detecting the crime, but it's also about reassuring the community. The local detectives were already on the scene here when I arrived. And we were beginning to preserve the scene and make arrangements to remove the body, having photographed and then start the process of fingerprinting and taking DNA samples from where we could. When you enter a crime scene of this sort, you start to form in your mind an idea of what sort of offender has committed the crime, and in particular, what sort of weapons have been used and where the offender might have been and what the offender might have touched and why the offender would be in the house. Sometimes these things, there's an argument, there's a flare-up and a killing takes place. Usually that's without too much violence and too much savagery in the attack, but in this case there was much more violence used than would have normally been expected. Was it a robbery that had gone wrong? Was it purely and simply an argument between two people that knew each other? Was it something that was more sinister than that? Very much at the beginning, if you can capture as much of that information as you can, as early as you can, then you're much more likely to be successful in the investigation.
The concern was right from the start that there was no allegation of a forced entry. It appeared that Morris Hoyle might have opened the door to his attacker.
So you start to establish links with people that would have lawful access to the house, people that might have visited the house, to pull together a picture of where your lines of inquiry were going to take you.
But in this case, there was little to go on. Morris Hoyle had no enemies, he had no known visitors, so it seemed that whoever the murderer was, he'd been expected. But there was no suggestion who that might have been.
A lot of people living in this particular area wouldn't be averse to leaving their doors open. It was a small location where people would know each other and make use of being able to pop into each other's houses from time to time.
The old adage is that an Englishman's home should be his castle. It certainly wasn't for Morris Hoyle. He'd only lost his wife of more than 40 years, just a few months earlier. And his son David had only married a few months earlier and left home. So for the first time in his life, he was living alone. And I think initially they were surprised that anybody was in the house with him. it looked as though he'd invited somebody into his home, and his hospitality had been repaid in the foulest way possible. Police were certainly knocking on doors, asking neighbours, anybody, even stopping people even walking along the street, you know, were you here, you know, that night, did you see anything, did you hear anything? They were also going to Morris's haunts, places he visited, asking people there if they could throw any light on the matter.
It was a matter of putting together all the material that we could find from the inquiries that we would make. And that would give us a picture of what Mr. Hoyle was doing and how he lived his life and who he associated with.
One thought was a family member may be responsible. 80% of murders are committed by people known to the victim. And in this case, there had been no forced entry.
Anybody who knew Morris Hoyle, including members of his family, were being looked at very, very carefully. I worked alongside the son of Morris Hoyle, David. There had been an argument with his father at around the time that he left home, and that was known. So I think initially he was not only informed of his father's sudden death in horrific circumstances, but I think he also found himself being questioned very, very closely. And I actually saw David by the police station. You could tell just by looking at him, he was absolutely ashen white and shaking, and could hardly say that what had happened.
But Morris's son was quickly discounted as a suspect after giving a statement. But on further investigation inside the home, police discovered clues that would take them in a new direction. Homosexual pornography suggested Morris had been keeping a secret and opened up new lines of inquiry. And police also found a number of items were missing, including an expensive watch. And that would lead police to a suspect seen with the watch. His name was Ian Burley.
Ian Burley became a suspect because of things that he tried to sell. Items from the house, including a watch. In 1995, I think it was that year of no employment, no hope. Ian Burley, he was down and out, you know, without money and without fixed address.
Indeed, Burley was known to sleep on the streets, often in the Oakwell area, and he was a drug addict. Now he was in possession of items, possibly from Morris's house. So detectives decided to pull Ian Burley in for questioning.
Before the murder of Morris Hoyle, he'd hardly kind of checked on the radar. Morris Hoyle had just been out for a normal evening out. I understand that he had visited Barnsley's Trades Club, and either there or perhaps more likely on the way home in the Oakwell area of Barnsley, he'd encountered Ian Burley, and they'd got chatting and invited Burley into his home. His temper when Morris Hoyle attempted to kiss him. Once inside one's own home, you don't expect anybody to be on the receiving end of such violence.
Whether it was a planned robbery or an angry reaction to unwanted advances, only Burley would know.
Ian Burley actually admitted manslaughter on the grounds of provocation. I think many people felt
were greatly relieved when he was brought to justice and indeed given a life sentence.
But when Burley went to prison, it wouldn't be the end of bloodshed in Barnsley. In 2015, the murder of John Gogarty would bear an eerie resemblance to Barnsley's past.
There were huge similarities between the two cases. Both were men in their 60s, both were killed at home, and both were killed in pretty brutal and horrifying attacks.
This victim had been stabbed 69 times in his own home. Once again, this was a man with no known enemies and no signs of a forced entry. The only motive was the idea that John had been targeted for his money by someone he knew.
John was financially comfortable, I believe that. He had numerous properties. He had a nice collection of designer watches. People were aware that he had money, local people.
Police on this inquiry had found a receipt from a nearby cash point close to John's body. And it appeared that money was the motivation for the murder.
The police released a CCTV footage showing a young woman in a hoodie with a baseball cap wrapped up using the cash machine and withdrawing £500 from John Gogarty's account.
As it happens, this led to the public identifying this person, Helen Nichols. Helen Nichols was a drug user. She had been involved in crime, but it was more minor things like shoplifting. She'd never been involved in anything of this nature.
Detectives learned that Nichols lived close to John Gogarty and she'd used his bank card to withdraw cash. But cops then learned that Nichols had a boyfriend, a man with previous convictions for murder, a man called Ian Burley. South Yorkshire Police were investigating the brutal murder of 69-year-old John Gogarty. They've identified local drug user Helen Nichols from CCTV and connected her to Ian Burley, a man who had previously killed Maurice Hoyle and was now out of prison on parole.
There was anger. I think a lot of people were really angry that an individual like that could be walking around unchecked.
I don't think that anybody, in other than perhaps the police, were actually aware that Ian Burley had been allowed on out on parole.
Five weeks previously, he had interrupted a conversation I was having with a friend to ask me if I was a Celtic fan. I looked at him, I didn't know who this man was. And I said, yes, I am. He called me an IRA petrol bomb throwing, child killing son of a bee, and stood beside a pillar with one arm concealed. I went to move towards him, and three men grabbed me and said, no, no, and other men got him to leave the bar. That was Ian Burley. I now believe that Ian Burley was carrying a weapon when he interrupted the conversation, spoke to me, and tried to provoke me into action.
I understand he was at liberty approximately 18 months before the murder of John Gogarty.
Since leaving prison, Burley had returned to the Barnsley area. He got a girlfriend and a drugs habit. Now they were both in custody on suspicion of murder. And while he denied any involvement, she was making admissions.
Her case throughout was that she had not been aware that Burley was going to kill Mr. Gogarty. She claimed they were going there essentially just to frighten him, get his money and then leave. He said that the CCTV footage that showed him and Nichols walking towards Mr. Gogarty's house minutes before the murder was her, but a completely different man who he couldn't name. He was asked where he was at the time of the murder, and he gave the strange answer where he said, "I think I was at home waiting for Emmerdale to come on, but that can't be right as I didn't have a sofa at the time." And that was his answer.
But it wouldn't be long before police had concrete evidence of what had happened.
So 3 days after being arrested, Nichols took police to a key piece of evidence, which was the burnt-out murder weapon and some clothing in some nearby woods, where Burley and herself had attempted to dispose of the evidence linking them to the crime.
And when police dug a little further, they found out that Burley had a motive for the crime.
It soon transpired that Burley owed a considerable drug debt of around £500 to a Sheffield drug dealer, and he was actually under incredible pressure to pay this money back. A burnt-out cigarette had been posted through his letterbox with a petrol can left outside, so he was clearly in fear for his own safety. There was this considerable drugs connection in terms of motive. And Mr. Gogarty was known in the local community both as a property developer but also as someone who did have a bit of money and would carry cash with him, and they thought essentially that he was an easy target and a likely source of money. Helen Nichols and Ian Burley came to Mr. Gogarty's house. They'd followed him from the pub. He'd got the television on, he'd got his slippers on. Mr. Gogarty had been stabbed initially, threatened. He'd handed over at that stage his PIN number and his card, and Helen Nichols had then gone to the local cash machine to withdraw money. When she came back, Ian Burley stabbed John Gogarty 69 times. Some of the blows were so hard, they broke the bone in his ribs. It was an absolutely horrendous, horrifying attack. And they left him there in a fetal position to die. And not only left him there, they went through his house, stole money from his back pocket, stole money from his bedroom, stole a watch, took champagne from the fridge and left. It was callous, appalling act.
When I found out after how brutal it had been, that again upset me quite a lot, you know, because sometimes you think, gosh, if we hadn't had that little argument and we'd have been best buddies like we were, he may have been with me, or I may have been going down to him, and the opportunity wouldn't have arisen for Mr. Burley.
The attempts by Burley and Nichols to cover their tracks were limited at best. There was so much evidence, Burley had said, prior to the killing, that Irish Paddy needed robbing. There was the receipt left at the scene. There was limited attempts to dispose of evidence, but a bloodstained T-shirt was found in the house. A bottle of champagne was found open in Burley's flat, indicating that they must have drunk from it and presumably celebrated what they'd just done. And when police visited the home of the Sheffield drug dealer, they found one of Mr. Gogarty's watches there, covered in blood from the murder. The court case was an emotional experience, particularly for Mr. Gogarty's family, who a large number of them travelled over from Ireland to hear each day of evidence. His defence was bizarre, to be honest. Bloody T-shirts were found. There was CCTV footage. There was so much evidence against him. It was almost quite extraordinary that he didn't plead guilty. He maintained throughout basically a poker face and showed little to no emotion. The motive, while despicable, was simple. So it didn't take long for the case to be heard, and it certainly didn't take long for the jury to come back with their verdicts of guilty. The judge was very, very clear that Ian Burley will die in prison and there's no prospect of him being released. We can only hope that that is the case. He's clearly not a person who should be at liberty.
You just couldn't believe that he'd learnt nothing from his 18 years of incarceration.
Ian Burley has taken two lives of two people who were living only a few miles away from each other in terms of where the murder scenes were. The family of Mr. Gogarty were extremely dignified throughout the trial. However, it's clear and completely understandable that they were angry and bemused, really, as to why Ian Burley had been let out of prison and then gone and done exactly, almost, what he'd done 20 years previously.
When I found out that they were being charged with murder, it was in one way a relief, and it helped me to move on, because finally I could feel I could pay some respects without being the finger of suspicion being on me. So I walked down to John's house with what was a flower with just a note in it, and said my goodbyes at his front gate, and I have never walked by that house again.
Having a killer in the community is bad enough, but in this case, Barnsley endured a killer who was able to strike twice more than 20 years apart. This was a man who had used extreme violence once, and given his second chance at freedom, would torment the same community with further savagery. He'd even bring others into his criminal ways. In Murder Town, it seems, even when a killer is locked up, you can't be sure that they won't strike again.
Do you feel it?